Ellis Nasour takes us behind the scenes and tells us that as Andrew Lloyd Webber and Tim Rice got down to serious work, the first tune conceived was for a scene they envisioned as a tirade against Jesus. The music already existed, taken from a half-composed tune about Moses and the prophet Samuel from the abandoned King David, but the arrangement would be something much more intense. They titled it Christ, and almost immediately imagined if they chose a title like that, especially for a hard rock song, it would be like walking into quicksand, especially in the much more secular U.S. They settled on Jesus Christ. The composers still felt that might also rain controversy on them, and it was briefly renamed I Only Want to Know. Andrew had this tune for 2 or 3 months. Da, 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 Rice explained in an interview. We just wanted a really good moving rhythm track. Chunk, chunk, chunk. Rice found working on the new lyrics easy because he knew the type of questions he wanted the character, Everyman, to ask. And by setting it in the 20th century rather than in the first, the questions struck a strong contemporary chord, he said. The tune Andrew produced for this briefest of ventures is now one of the best known he has ever composed. When King David was in the frame, the lyric began, Samuel, Samuel, this is the first book of Samuel. Just a few months later, I wrote, Jesus Christ, Jesus Christ, who are you, what have you sacrificed? To the same strident and unforgettable notes. If Rice stunned with the lyrics, Lloyd Webber did the same with his ability to create a fierce arrangement. The finished composition provided Everyman with a blistering tirade that grew in power with a mashup of symphony orchestra, pop, rock, and soul, as they had accidentally and successfully hit upon in Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat. Meanwhile, Rice worried that the oft-repeated Jesus Christ was boring and decided he needed a word to aptly describe Jesus in all his power and glory. A trade ad in Melody Maker caught his eye. It referred to singer Tom Jones as the world's number one superstar. It seemed like every pop star was being called a superstar, and who better than Jesus Christ should have that title? I loved the word superstar, which seemed only recently to have been coined, even though the Oxford English Dictionary lists an instance of superstar with hyphen being used as far back as 1925. As it fitted the scansion of the hook of the chorus so perfectly, I wrote a new second couplet, Jesus Christ, superstar, do you think you're what they say you are? They are probably the most important lines I have ever written as far as our careers were concerned. They were at once shocking, yet respectful and unforgettable. Without changing a word of the lyrics, he rechristened the tune Superstar. Superstar, a relatively short song with 2 main verses, 7 lines each, and the 2-line stanza was destined to become the rock opera's most recognizable anthem and one of the best known he ever composed. Lloyd Webber has stated he considers it the best 3-chord tune I have ever written. Nasour, looking back, writes, it's amazing that after 50 years and counting, Jesus Christ Superstar, the rock opera on record and in literally hundreds of stagings annually worldwide, is still popular, still relevant. The reason is the story, said Tim Rice. It's a great story. The primary duty of anyone writing a play or book or making a film or whatever is to tell a great story and to make the characters truthful because then people identify with them. And that's the key. People can read what they want into it on top of the basic story, which is something that is universal to so many countries. Jesus Christ Superstar has spawned three Broadway revivals, a 2012 Lloyd Webber-produced televised competition series to cast the titular role for a British arena tour, and a live Easter Sunday 2018 televised NBC production that starred John Legend as Jesus and, in quite the casting coup, Alice Cooper as Herod, resulting in Emmy wins for Rice and Lloyd Webber. It continued with the 2021, 2022, and beyond with the 50th anniversary Jesus Christ Superstar American Tour that was a revival of the acclaimed Regent Park production, not to mention the 2023 deluxe reissue of the rock opera, much delayed because of COVID. 51 years since the album came out, blimey, Rice said. Lloyd Webber, looking back, said, "Everything I was doing was all instinct." He added, "Yes, we had some amateur productions, but we'd never had anything in the professional theater, and I don't know whether that would have influenced us for good or bad." He thought for a second. Without sounding immodest, he chuckled, "It's actually rather good." That from Ellis Nasur in the study, Jesus Christ Superstar, behind the scenes of the worldwide musical phenomenon. There are many who would agree with Andrew Lloyd Webber that the musical is actually rather good. And two of those who are passionate about the show paid a visit to the WVIA studio to talk about the upcoming production at the Little Theater of Wilkes-Barre opening this weekend. David Parmalee, the theater's general manager, and Dave Beloga, the production's director. The keeper of history at the Little Theater of Wilkes-Barre is David Parmalee, and he continues to discover more and more each year.
Doesn't it seem like a month ago we were meeting to celebrate the 100th season? I remember the gala and people came back who hadn't been in town in quite a while for it. It was such a thrill. And here we are, right in the middle of the 103rd season. And God bless us, everyone, going strong. And that's our goal, to produce excellent theater that our friends and our neighbors can enjoy at a very affordable price and stay in business. That would be the second goal. But funny you should mention, I just did some research on newspapers.com, and it's incredible what's out there. Tony Brooks recommended it to me. And the theater is built, as far as we could tell, this is the oldest reference I could find, in 1916, and they were advertising silent movies in 1919. 1941, they gutted it. It was very small, and there are actually five apartments on the second floor. And we found the ad for when they were selling the used materials from the apartments. And they roughly tripled the size. And the Comerford chain was very proud of what they had built. A luxurious lounge for the ladies, which is still pretty much the same. And every modern convenience, including an exhaust system for cigarette smoke, which is up on the roof. It's a giant fan in its own little building. And what a glamorous place it was. And of course, we bought it in 1955 and opened it for live performance in 1956. And it's been our home ever since. What has changed more than anything is the material. There is so much more to draw from than the Golden Age musicals that Little Theater did back at that time, and the plays as well. And here we are talking about Jesus Christ Superstar, which is now a classic, right? 1970. I have the album at home, so I hope that makes me a classic.
If you have the album, David, that means you were around when it opened.
I was on a panel discussion at the 44th Presbyterian Church where the youth group was called in to the weekly meeting or monthly meeting of the congregation because people were nonplussed by it. I imagine some people were outraged by it. How can you have rock and roll Christ? My grandparents, who were born 1907, were deacons and trustees at that church. And there I was, 13 years old, and we thought it was pretty cool. And we talked about that. Little did those folks know we would see things like Life of Brian, not that far down the road. If you really want to be outraged, we'll supply you with the material. But I've come to appreciate it as the years have gone by as a certainly modern and at times irreverent look at the Gospels, but an account that through his lens is gentle most of the time. It's true most of the time. He tries to find the feelings that are in those sparse words of the Gospel and expand them into song and choreography and lyrics. And I think it is respectful. Obviously, they're making fun of people like Herod, who I think earned it. But I think it has held up pretty well in that respect. And I think Weber and Rice felt some obligation to get it right. And it's easy to forget how young they were. I mean, they were part of rock and roll, so to speak, of that scene. And the music is brilliant. And of course, he'd go on to produce much more. But I think it's easy to say it's his most fun show.
What's compelling about it for you, Dave, that you said this is one of the ones that I will give my energy to?
The music sells it for me. You know, I've heard various recordings, albums through the years of the production, but there was a particular recording that really kind of had a harder edge to it, kind of a harder rock edge to it.
The weekly meeting or monthly meeting of the congregation, because people were nonplussed by it. I imagine some people were outraged by it. How can you have rock and roll Christ? My grandparents, who were born 1907, were deacons and trustees at that church. And there I was, 13 years old, and we thought it was pretty cool. And we talked about that. Little did those folks know, we would see things like Life of Brian, you know, not that far down the road. If you really want to be outraged, we'll supply you with the material. But I've come to appreciate it as the years have gone by as a certainly modern and at times irreverent look at the Gospels, but an account that through his lens is gentle most of the time. It's true most of the time. He tries to find the feelings that are in those sparse words of the Gospel and expand them into song and choreography and lyrics. And I think it is respectful. Obviously, they're making fun of people like Herod, who I think earned it. But I think it has held up pretty well in that respect. And I think Weber and Rice felt some obligation to get it right. And it's easy to forget how young they were. I mean, they were part of rock and roll, so to speak, of that scene. And the music is brilliant. And of course, he'd go on to produce much more. But I think it's easy to say it's his most fun show.
What's compelling about it for you, Dave, that you said this is one of the ones that I will give my energy to?
The music sells it for me. You know, I've heard various recordings, albums through the years of the production, but there was a particular recording that really kind of had a harder edge to it, kind of a harder rock edge to it. I think the 96 London recording remastered in 2005, that really kind of put in a whole other perspective for me. And I think that's, you know, just hearing that album really sold me on the music on the show. The fact that it's a rock opera, it's all sung too. I think I love music that tells stories. So I think the brilliance of it is just hearing the music, something like the overture, and how does the overture tell the story, set the scenario of what we're about to hear, even though it's a familiar story to most people. But how does the music just from the overture set the stage, figuratively and literally? And I think that that's what appeals to me most, just the music, both instrumental and the vocals, that really beautifully tell the story.
I was there at the theater last night, the first rehearsal with the orchestra, and I'm not directly involved in the show, but I came to see that first rehearsal. And we last did it a decade ago, exactly a decade ago. And I was in the lobby, and I heard those three chords that start the overture. And I went, oh, there it is. There's nothing like it in musical theater, I think. Those three chords is so powerful. They're almost Wagnerian. And I went, oh, that delicious sound. It's going to be a great production. Great vocalists, outstanding live orchestra, which you see less and less often these days. A lot of theater is done to audio tracks, and that works too. But we really enjoy having actual musicians creating their art at the same time that the actors, vocalists, and dancers create theirs. And that rock opera term, there's so much room in that. I guess the first acknowledged one is Tommy. People love Tommy, but it's somewhat disjointed, and the plot is something from an acid flashback. And there have been rock operas since, in fact, pretty recently, but the plot is kind of loosely stitched together, and it borders sometimes on being a jukebox musical. And again, nothing wrong with that. But the nice thing about this, Jim Harris, who was part of WVIA at one time, volunteered here and was a general manager of Little Theater, said to me once he went to a guitar workshop with Loudon Wainwright, whose famous song, the medley of his hit, is Dead Skunk in the Middle of the Road. I'm sure he did other things too. But Loudon said, you know, I have a high squeaky voice and it sounds funny, so I do comedic songs because that it really suits it best. And he said to this group, and I have remembered this since Jim told me this 20 years ago, your style is determined by your limitations. If you have complete freedom and anything can happen, maybe nothing happens. Maybe you don't do anything particularly special. And I really enjoy writing myself as a playwright when I have fence posts, when I have to work within a box, and we say, what can we do about that? How could that work? And here we have what maybe is the second major rock opera, which was conceived as a performance, not as a musical. You know, when it first came to the United States from the West End, the first place it played was Three Rivers Stadium. And if you look in the original album, there's a sketch in the beginning of the liner notes, which is a booklet packed in there. It's very luxurious. And there are four people sketched. Yvonne Eilman is one of them, Jesus, Judas, and the lead guitarist from Procol Harum, who was the lead guitarist on the album. Weber and Rice thought of it as a rock performance. But in the world of rock, which is completely free form, you do what you want, what did they choose as their limitation, which created their style? A gospel story that is not only very well documented, but universally known, and you can't change it too much. And I think that's the brilliance of it. The main thing they seem to have done, I think most critics would say, is they needed a bad guy. Who is the bad guy in the Passion? Is it the local authorities? Is it the Romans? Who is it? Well, you don't want a bad committee in an opera. You need a bad guy. For Faust, you need the devil. For Otello, you need Iago. And of course, so many operas are based on stories we already know like that. So Weber said, aha, Judas. Now, Judas only did one bad thing, and it didn't take long. And he regretted it immediately afterwards. And the most tragic painting never painted is Judas asking Christ for forgiveness at the foot of the cross. And of course, he would have received it, because he was truly remorseful, so remorseful that he suffered from despair, committed suicide, the only act for which you cannot act forgiveness, and did not ask forgiveness of Christ. So there's a particular tragedy to Judas. But in a way, he's a small figure in the plot. And here we have these brilliant musicians saying, well, we have to write an opera. Let's bring him up big, and in a rock and roll way, and in a very operatic way. So I think that's maybe the main change from the gospel in the plot, but he hews very closely to the events. And I love that. And I think that's what makes the thing so enduring in a way that maybe other rock operas are not.
You know, a lot of people are familiar with the story, and maybe the controversy when it was first released was, is this album, is this musical too sympathetic about Jesus? Does it portray Jesus in too humane of a fashion and not recognizing him as divine, as well as human? But I think, you know, it takes an interesting take on Judas, you know, and looks at it from his perspective. And I don't think he's the only one, you know, in the show that struggles with their relationship with Jesus and what being a follower of his is all about. I mean, certainly it's portrayed in the musical, Judas having concerns about Jesus's popularity and the people and the oppression from the Romans as well as the religious leaders at the time. But there are other characters in the story that between Peter and Simon Zelotes don't quite, Simon shows in the musical, he doesn't quite get it. And then Peter, we know, denies him three times. So they weren't perfect. So I think it shows that followers of Jesus, as recorded in the Gospels as well as in this musical, you know, we're not perfect. And sometimes they, you know, misinterpreted the message, had other concerns. And I think that's the beauty of it, as well as anyone watching the show. Who do we see this person as Jesus as, whether you're a believer or non-believer? I believe his life and, you know, the stories and the message of the gospel, what's presented, gives us a choice, presents us with the choice of who do we see Jesus as. And that's another thing that I love about this production and presenting it live in front of people, to really kind of encounter this person of Jesus and his relationship to his followers, to his disciples. And how do you see yourself in this picture, potentially as one of those followers that we're not perfect, but how do we view him, and how do we follow him, and what do we do with his message and who he is as a person?
Peter always does the right thing, but never right away. Never. It's a good lesson to all of us, right? Eventually you get it. God says, well, it's okay. I was hoping you'd come around.
We were laughing before we started because, David, your daughter sent you her list, or her sister. They got
the two
together.
Sisters. Yeah,
two sisters.
A playlist.
Tell us what happened.
Yeah. Well, they're kind of, they enjoy Broadway and they enjoy old rock and roll. You know, they're very diverse tastes. And my daughter Susanna's favorite musical is 1776, and she can recite it. We had a VHS tape and she would watch it 2 days a week after school. Knows it word for word. But they looked at this more as a musical selection. And she and Andrea put this together. Their number one song is Heaven on Their Minds. That's one they like the best. What's the Buzz? Well, who can argue with that, right? Great song. The Temple, and then Hosanna. And Dave, you took issue with that. You said, well, that's not my playlist.
No, I feel like some of those selections, other than Heaven, are just very repetitive. So I would lean towards, you know, Heaven and Gethsemane, and even Jesus Christ the Superstar is more kind of, well, songs that I particularly like, you know, and find great love for.
Well, you have to direct it. That's different.
Yeah, yeah. You know, my thing with directing, when something as repetitive as What's the Buzz is just like the cast constantly has to be moving and doing something because they're just standing there singing the same lyrics over and over again, or slightly different lyrics. It can kind of seem monotonous or boring. So keeping that energy up even while singing the same lyrics over and over again. But I think you could still tell a story, you know, that one thing I tell the cast over and over again, if you're singing something or you're saying a line over and over again, make sure each time gets bigger and that it's going somewhere, that it's not just reciting the same or singing the same thing over and over again, but it has a drive to it. It's going somewhere. But I would lean toward Heaven and, you know, Gethsemane and Superstar as my
great
favorites.
great songs.
You said, did you, Dave, that you directed it in 2010? Mm-hmm. And so that's what, 15 years ago?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
How about you? Have you changed? Has your point of view, have you gotten, as you've matured as a person, because we all do grow, I think, in that time, and then, of course, the world around us, how do you bring this production to us 15 years later?
Sure. I'm kind of reprising the same vision that I had for the show with a modern concept, basically the concept of what if Jesus came today? And I did that back in 2010, and I'm continuing that now. Although our world is very different, obviously, even from 15 years ago. You always kind of go back to your notes from a production that you directed before, and I still had my score and my notes from the director. But I know a lot of the things I, you know, had written in there, I'm like, I don't know if some of these work today. I think some things are different. Our world is different today, and I think the enduring message, certainly of the Gospels, the Bible, and also this musical, is just, although our world is different, although our human experience has evolved and changed, the person of Jesus and what's presented on the stage version, in a sense, remains the same, but just our world around, you know, that revolves around it has changed, and how do we look at it differently? But I think looking at Jesus and the struggle of these people in the relation to him still remains the same, even though I'm reprising the same production that I directed 15 years ago, but there are some things different, and certainly the audience is different in how they approach their relationship to this person, this Jesus of Nazareth, as presented on the stage.
What about the women?
There's one woman lead, Mary Magdalene, who talks about her relationship with Jesus. And like I said, everyone in the show, I think, is portrayed, you know, after encountering Jesus, whether they get his message or not. Mary presents a beautiful story in the musical that her life has changed. And she sings a song, I don't know how to love him. She's encountered this Jesus who's like no other person she's ever met in her life, especially men. I mean, the context and the connotation in the musicals that she is a prostitute alludes to that. But she talks about how who she is as a person has changed in light of getting to know Jesus. So that encounter leads to some type of conversion on her part, and she struggles with her old way of life and her new way of life after following him, and which really I think is beautifully expressed in the song, I Don't Know How to Love Him. And so I think she, more than anybody else in the musical, beautifully portrays a conversion story of encountering this Jesus, having her life changed by him for the better. You know, she's kind of letting go of her old way of life and embracing something new that brings her more fulfillment, joy in encountering him. But at the same time, the struggle, like, I don't know what to do with all this because it's new, it's different, but I want to pursue this because I know it's good, even though I don't know how it's going to wind up, but I know it's where I need to head.
There are a lot of people in this cast.
Yeah, we have a cast of about 30 to play many different roles. I think sometimes even the cast struggles to remember like what role they're particularly playing, you know, whether it be apostle, a follower of Jesus, or part of the mob that later on turns against him, as well as other individual parts that spread throughout the show. So there's a lot for the cast to do. It's definitely an ensemble, strong show where the cast is constantly portraying a particular character in group numbers, and the way I'm directing the show, there's a lot of movement on stage between the set and reconfigured platforms and things. So the cast is constantly busy throughout the whole show between changing characters, changing costumes, moving set pieces. So it's a very fast-paced moving show with a lot to do, both character-wise and set-wise.
That's a big set. Mm-hmm. I mean, monumental. I don't think I've seen a set of that scale in quite some time. Yeah. And it's all movable.
It's all movable,
yeah. So it's good you have 30 people.
Yeah, yeah. You know, sometimes I feel like there can be a great distance between what's happening on stage and the audience, and I really want to try to bring some of it downstage and still be big. So like some of the stuff is right up with the audience. And I like the levels too, that there's definitely a lot of power struggle in the show between the priests, high priest Caiaphas and Pilate, and who has the actual real power. And I also wanted to try to convey that set wise and make it look interesting, because there's a lot of movement going on during the show. So I like a lot of movement to really draw people in and keep their attention.
I love to hear that. We are the biggest community theater in the area by far. And as Mr. Monk used to say, it's a gift and a curse. It's a gift because we can do things with a 34-foot high proscenium, 36 feet wide, 31 feet deep. I mean, that's an awful lot of space. And I think you've got actually three levels. You're on the floor. There's a second level with two giant staircases going up. And then the orchestra is actually on the third level. The curse is we have to heat the building. So that's our problem. But a show like this really benefits from that sort of staging. And I can't wait to see what your work does for the audience. I think it's going to be the spectacle, which is part of theater, is going to add to the music.
David, you know where we can see it, but tell us where.
Right, 537 North Main, right? Yeah.
The dates of the
yes,
show?
Yes, okay. Traditionally Superstar is produced during the Lenten or Easter season. And Dave said, I think, a very insightful thing. We were talking yesterday that to some folks, it is sort of a passion play or a Stations of the Cross type experience. And of course, that is an ancient, ancient tradition. When music, choreography, acting it is added to that process of visiting the Passion or the Stations, I think it's important to people. So it is generally done in the springtime around Easter. We're opening Friday, the 21st. And we're closing on the 30th of March, and it's Fridays and Saturdays at 8, and then Sunday matinees at 3, which are very, very popular. Come in the daylight. We've got three parking lots all within a minute of the theater, so very easy to navigate, etc. And folks do enjoy the matinee performances. This is when I think I would order my tickets early. The show is doing quite well at the box office already. One of the most popular shows, I think, in the Broadway canon. So we would love to share that with you.
David Parmalee, general manager of the Little Theater of Wilkes-Barre, and Dave Beloga, who is director of this production, speaking with us about Jesus Christ Superstar with music by Andrew Lloyd Webber and lyrics by Tim Rice. The performances run from March 21st through the 30th, Friday and Saturday evenings at 8, Sunday matinees at 3. The Little Theater is located at 537 North Main Street in Wilkes-Barre. There is an assistant director, and that's Kristen Hudak, and a musical director, Jen Hunter, and all the cast and crew. The website, ltwb.org, ltwb.org.